Irish men and Irish women, in the name of God and of the dead generations from which she receives her old tradition of nationhood, Ireland, through us, summons her children to her flag and strikes for her freedom. She now seizes that moment and, supported by her exiled children in America and by gallant allies in Europe, but relying in the first on her own strength, she strikes in full confidence of victory. Six times during the past 300 years, they have asserted it in arms. We hereby proclaim the Irish Republic as a sovereign, independent state.
Welcome to Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of Happiness, a podcast commemorating the 250-year anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. The show is sponsored by the Amerikazentrum in Hamburg, Germany, and I'm your host, Andrew Sola. Our theme today, as you might have heard from that wonderful introduction, is Ireland and the Declaration of Independence. Today, about 7 million people live on the island of Ireland, and in the United States, about 32 million people claim Irish ancestry. So roughly one out of every 10 people you meet on the streets in America is at least partly Irish. Indeed, the Irish have been an important part of American history since its very founding. Three of the original signers of the Declaration of Independence were born in Ireland, and five additional signers were Irish Americans. Statistics are hard to come by, but historians claim that about half of the soldiers in George Washington's Continental Army were Irish. Even if that number is slightly inflated, it's safe to say that many Irishmen fought and died in the War of Independence on the American side, and indeed, others fought and died on the British side. As much as Ireland has shaped American history, so has America shaped Irish history. The United States recognized the Irish Free State in 1924, and American political leaders have been influential in promoting peace on the island of Ireland for many, many years. And many of those leaders, from John F. Kennedy to Joseph R. Biden, were, of course, Irish Americans. So today we're going to explore Ireland and its relationship to the United States and the Declaration of Independence. What was Ireland like in the 1700s? Why did the Irish move to the colonies? What did they think about rebellion against Britain? And how did the Declaration of Independence influence Irish politics back home? Here with me today to answer those questions is a leading expert on Irish history, Professor Patrick Gagan. Welcome, Patrick.
Thanks, Andrew.
Patrick is the director of the Trinity Long Room Hub, the Arts and Humanities Research Institute at Trinity College Dublin, where he is professor of history. He has published extensively on the British-Irish relationship and Irish political history in the 18th and 19th centuries. He also presents the award-winning weekly radio program, Talking History, on News Talk Radio in Ireland. And what's great about this radio show is you can listen to it as a podcast, and I will provide a link to that fantastic Talking History show in the notes. And yes, I must say, I am a subscriber and a big fan. It's really fun. So, Patrick, you read a passage that sounded a lot like the Declaration of Independence, but of course, what we heard there is a lot of Ireland there and the Irish people. So why did you choose to begin our episode today by citing the 1916 proclamation in Ireland?
Well, I suppose the 1916 proclamation is our Declaration of Independence. There was a separate Declaration of Independence in the Irish Parliament in 1919, and I could have quoted from that, but that's not really well known. It's not famous in Ireland or outside of Ireland, whereas the 1916 proclamation was very much and is very much seen as our 1776 document, and it was hugely inspired and influenced by Jefferson's document. So in 1916, Patrick Pearse went outside of the GPO on the main street in Dublin, and he read out that proclamation, and it kick-started a rebellion that was defeated, but out of that failure came a war of independence, and that was what then led to the treaty and the creation of the Irish state then in 1922.
Yeah, and also what I was struck by is sort of, I don't want to use the word the extremity of the rhetoric there, but there are passages in that that are very forceful. And when you read the American Declaration of Independence, you have really forceful language against King George, calling him a tyrant, unfit to rule, and all of these things. Do you think rhetorically they wanted to be revolutionary in the same way?
I think so. And I think it's interesting the way even that opening, the opening three words are Irish men and Irish women, that they were making a very bold statement there that this was going to be a revolution and a republic for all. It references America because so many Irish had ended up in America in the 18th century, and then especially in the 19th century after the famine, during and after the famine. And then it's also referencing previous rebellions. It references how six times in the past 300 years, the Irish had asserted their rights in arms and liberty. But so many of those six times, four of them, were directly influenced by America. 1798, 1803, 1848, 1867. And your point about the rhetoric is absolutely right. It's the exact same thing. It's a foreign power who is responsible for all of the ills in Ireland, and that once that foreign power is removed, everything will be fine in Ireland. So there are references to those in Ireland who believe they wanted to remain part of Britain, they wanted to be part of the empire, those from a unionist tradition and background. And it very much places the blame on Britain, and it suggests that once Britain is removed from the equation, those people would want to join an Irish Republic. So there's an element of wishful thinking there as well, and it's very much demonizing the external power, and that is Britain.
Right. One curious thing, just because I've been thinking about this in relation to another episode, the use of the phrase Irish men and Irish women is a little bit different from the American Declaration, which refers to just the people. And this concept of the people in the American Declaration of Independence is just kind of vague. You know, what is the people? Who are the people? Who wants to be part of the people? Whereas in Ireland, and I think this is one important difference, this is clearly for Irish men and women.
Yes, and of course there were debates in Ireland about what the American Declaration of Independence meant, and the great nationalist leader in the 19th century, Daniel O'Connell, was scathing about the American Declaration. He called it a hypocritical document because it declared that all men were created equal, but actually that wasn't true because of the sin of slavery. And so you see the influence of James Connolly, the radical socialist leader and one of the signatories of the Irish Proclamation, in that this was going to be an equal revolution and this was going to be for all. But there is also a line in the proclamation that is completely misunderstood in Ireland today and historically, where it references cherishing all of the children of the nation equally. And whenever you have a scandal or a crisis in Ireland where children had not been protected adequately, people always refer to that line. Or whenever there's something being said idealistically about wanting to do something for young people in Ireland, that line is always quoted. But actually, when you read the document, it had nothing to do with children, meaning small people. It actually meant all of the Irish people, Protestants and Catholic and people of no religion. And it was claiming allegiance from all of those and cherishing all of the Irish people. But it's very much a misunderstood line.
Fascinating. Okay, and we will eventually end where we started here, talking about the 1916 proclamation, but we need to roll the historical tape back several hundred years. And I want to start maybe just by thinking about Ireland in the 18th century. So I just want to start with this passage. This is a letter from Benjamin Franklin from 1772 after his trip to Ireland in the end of 1771. And this is what he described to his friend Thomas Cushing back in Massachusetts. Ireland is itself a fine country, and Dublin a magnificent city. But the appearances of general extreme poverty among the lower people are amazing. They live in wretched hovels of mud and straw, are clothed in rags, and subsist chiefly on potatoes. Our New England farmers of the poorest sort are princes when compared to them. Landlords rack the tenants and fleece them, skin and all, to make estates to themselves. An English gentleman there said to me that by what he had heard of the good grazing in North America, he could not understand why we did not rival Ireland in the beef and butter trade to the West Indies. But he was satisfied when I told him that I supposed the reason might be, and here in italics, our people eat beef and butter every day and wear shirts themselves. In short, the chief exports of Ireland seem to be pinched off the backs and out of the bellies of the miserable inhabitants. But schemes are now under consideration among the humane gentry to provide some means of mending, if possible, their present wretched condition. So, I mean, there what I see is a lot coming from Benjamin Franklin that we can unpack. First, we have an economic situation. We have references to transatlantic trade, which is a huge part of what we see in the Declaration of Independence. And then, of course, there's this huge political feature. So when you hear that, I mean, is Benjamin Franklin being hyperbolic, or is that a pretty reasonable explanation of what Ireland is like in 1772?
Benjamin Franklin is absolutely right, and he captures the problems on the island, he captures the divisions, he captures the poverty, and he's really describing a country that is, it's divided and it's broken, because it's divided on grounds of religion, class, politics, and it's really problematic because you have a majority Catholic population, 8/10 of the population, who are excluded from all political rights and representations. So you had a series of penal laws brought in the late 17th, early 18th century, restricting and excluding Catholics, and excluding Catholics from the body politic, from parliament, from even being able to vote. So they're an alienated, dispossessed group that don't have ownership of the land, don't have any political or civil rights. But then above them, you have a group of Protestants who do have the right to vote, do sit in Parliament, who consider themselves part of the Kingdom of Ireland, which is meant to be an equal kingdom with the Kingdom of Great Britain. But it's not really equal. And there are all these debates about whether Ireland is a kingdom or a colony. But really, the truth is, in the British eyes, Ireland is a colony. And they don't see it in any way equal. So when the American War of Independence breaks out, that group in the Irish Parliament are very much behind the British effort, but they are wanting to make sure that they are respected, that they are getting greater rights when it comes to trade. And it's really about respect. So their sympathies are with the American colonists, even though their loyalties are with the British, because they see that they are being treated in the same way. And it also brings home to them the fact that in Ireland, they're not really being seen as an equal kingdom. They're seen as Britain's first colony.
I want to follow up on two aspects of that. First, I just want to focus a little bit on the economics and then the politics. But maybe let's just start with the economics. So the sort of clear comparison that Franklin makes here is our New England farmers own their land and whatever they need. If they have cows, they can eat beef, make cheese and butter, they can clothe themselves, all of this stuff. What is the economic landscape like in Ireland where an Irish farmer cannot do that?
Yeah, there are restrictions on trade. There's restrictions on what can be done. And so there are grievances in the Irish Parliament about how it's limited in what it can do and the type of money. So actually, you see quite a lot of smuggling, and you see a lot of produce coming in from the American colonies and then being repackaged and repurposed here. But that's all going on unofficially. And then the people who are actually working the land, they have no real legal rights. Now, actually, reforms are brought in 1778 and 1782 to help the Catholics. And the Catholics are given ability to take leases on the land, and a lot of the restrictions around the practice of the religion are removed. And they're only brought in because Britain is afraid of the Irish rising up in rebellion. and going the same way as the American colonists. And so they have to get the Irish Catholics on board. And they also need Catholic soldiers in the army. So restrictions on Catholics serving in the military, they are also removed. So things become a little bit better for the Catholics in 1778 and 1782. And that's directly inspired and influenced by what's happening in America.
Okay, and let me take the political part of this too. You know, I understand the point you made that it's unclear if Ireland is a kingdom or a colony. I think before the Revolutionary War starts in America, everyone understood that, say, Virginia or Massachusetts was not a kingdom, but a colony. Can you just tease out some of the differences between, like, Ireland and the Irish Parliament at the time and, say, Virginia's form of self-government?
Ireland has its own parliament. 300 people sit in the House of Commons, and then roughly about 100 or so in the House of Lords. It's directly modelled on the British system. It calls itself a sister kingdom, but really it has no power. It is a parliament which is very much bound by the Declaratory Act and Poyning's Law. So it cannot bring in its own legislation. It can only consider legislation brought in by Britain. And Britain, through the Declaratory Act, has declared the right to legislate for Ireland. So it's essentially there just to rubber stamp things that are decided upon in Britain. And that is a huge grievance for this Protestant group of nationalists, but they're nationalists who don't want independence. They just want greater respect and they want a greater role in it. So they call themselves a sister kingdom, but they know in their hearts that they're not. They know they're inferior. They know that they're pretty much not that different from Virginia. In some ways, they're probably even inferior to Virginia. And that's a huge grievance for them.
Yeah, it seems to me that indeed, even though Virginia would not be considered a kingdom, there is actually substantially more self-governance in the North American colonies than there was in Ireland itself at the time.
And the French involvement in the war changes things dramatically, because once France enters the war in 1778, a lot of the British troops stationed in Ireland are taken out of Ireland to be brought back to Britain for the defence of Britain, and some of them are sent to America. And suddenly Ireland is somewhat defenceless. And so these volunteer companies set up to defend Ireland from French invasion. And you have the great patriots, Henry Grattan and so on, joining these volunteer companies, becoming leaders of them, going into Parliament wearing their red volunteers uniform. And even though these are ostensibly for the defence of Ireland against France, they actually become a kind of an extra parliamentary paramilitary force that can put pressure on the British government. So in 1778, the volunteers and the Parliament demand free trade or else. And they are the banners. And the or else is, if you do not give us free trade, if you do not show us greater respect, well, we will go the way of the American colonies. So it's a group designed and created to show its loyalty to the British Crown and the Empire, to defend Ireland as part of that war. But actually, it's used to demand greater rights. And the British government is terrified. So free trade is conceded. And in 1782, Henry Grattan is able to use the British defeats at Yorktown and the collapse of the war effort as a way of demanding legislative independence, that Ireland will be able to govern itself, still connected with Britain, but they'll have a measure of parliamentary independence. And he's able to succeed with that because, well, Britain can't afford to engage in a conflict with Ireland, and it's so afraid of losing Ireland, and the cost would be too great and the embarrassment would be too great. So it's interesting. You find a group of patriots who are loyal to Britain, who are nonetheless demanding greater rights from Britain, and pretty much at the barrel of a gun, because the threat is there. It's free trade or else, it's legislative independence or else, and Britain can't afford another conflict.
Yeah, it's fascinating. things there. The importance of free trade is often overlooked. It's one of the many grievances in the American Declaration of Independence. King George has restricted our trade with the rest of the world. It's a very short little grievance there, but it's has outsized importance throughout the transatlantic world. The second thing you've been hinting at that I find so interesting is there are various interpretations of independence based on where you're from. So the form of independence that we see in the American Declaration of Independence is indeed absolute full independence. No one sits over us to tell us what to do. We, the people, again, of America, are our own sovereign. What the Irish or some Irish patriots were looking at is something we might call like semi-political independence or legislative independence plus free trade. So do you want to just talk a little bit about those different forms of independence? Let's call it full independence versus legislative independence.
I think you're absolutely right, and that is crucial to it. So when someone like Henry Grattan delivers his speech in favor of legislative independence in 1782 and then rewrites it in later years and reinvents and reimagines what he said, in the reimagined version he says, "Spirit of Swift, spirit of Molyneux, your genius has prevailed. Ireland is now a nation, and in that spirit I greet you." But when he says Ireland is now a nation, he's really meaning a Protestant nation of those elite figures. And certainly many of the people in that Irish Parliament saw that their country, as they saw it, the people who they were representing, was that elite Protestant ascendancy. And they did not consider it a nation for all. So when they meant independence, they meant really a parliament that was able to legislate for itself, but very much part of the British Empire. There was no suggestion that it would go its separate way. It did not want its separate king. It did not want a different head of state. It still wanted to be aligned with Britain on all the crucial issues. And it was more maybe in some kind of federal structure that we might consider it today, that you have Ireland looking after its domestic affairs, Britain looking after its domestic affairs in its parliament, but they are very much united under the crown. But then there are others who, outside of that bubble, those who are very much excluded from political rights and representations, who become inspired by the American War of Independence and start thinking about proper independence or full independence. And that's breaking the connection with the crown. And that's about Ireland going the way of America and becoming an independent, separate country. And that becomes the big thing that the British government is afraid of and the Irish Parliament is afraid of in the 1780s and the 1790s. And it's accelerated then after the French Revolution in 1789. And the big fear is that now Ireland will go its separate way. But the people in the Irish Parliament, Henry Grattan, and those even on the more conservative side, like John Fitzgibbon, who becomes the Lord Chancellor at the end of the decade, and who believes very strongly in that close British connection, they do not want independence in any way, as we would understand it, like that.
I want to take this fascinating story back to the other side of the Atlantic, just to remind the audience of the famous figure of Benedict Arnold, who was an instrumental general on the Patriot side in the invasion of Canada, for example. But of course, he switches sides, and now in American slang, we refer to a Benedict Arnold as a traitor. The reason why he became a traitor or switched sides was precisely for this reason that Patrick just explained. The British were wise to the fact that their empire was getting unruly and that they needed to make some concessions. So I think it was after the Battle of Saratoga. I'll have to check my notes. But Britain then offered the colonies something like legislative independence, which many argue is what the Founding Fathers were arguing for in the Declaration of Independence anyway. So why, after several years of war, wouldn't they just accept what they really wanted, which was, like Ireland, free trade, legislative independence, stay out of our affairs, we'll kind of be loyal, but we'll have our own significant level of independence. Well, Benedict Arnold said, well, that seems like a good deal to me. Let's just have our legislative independence. Well, now he's considered a traitor, and that's that.
But you're absolutely right. And Elijah Gould, brilliant professor from University of New Hampshire and currently in Oxford as Harmsworth professor, he delivered a brilliant paper here in Trinity about that and talked about Lord Carlisle's attempts to deliver a peace deal and how Benedict Arnold cited the Peace Commission as the reason he switched sides in 1780. And he said the whole world saw that the king's terms exceeded our wishes and expectations, and that what the British were offering made Congress and not the British Parliament look like the aggressor. And it's interesting, Carlisle then ends up in Ireland as Lord Lieutenant, and he's the person who's there in 1780, and he plays a crucial part during that whole time when Grattan is demanding legislative independence. So yes, very much the Irish are following and they're studying what's happening in America, and I think in America they're also very much aware of some of the Irish demands and how that is all connected.
I want to maybe change focus a little bit right now. I'm still interested in the type of person who is immigrating from Ireland to the colonies in the 18th century. Can we just get a sense of maybe some of the push and pull factors that are driving Irish people to the colonies in the 18th century?
There is a mixture, and you could definitely say that in the 1840s, there is one particular type of Irish person who is going to America.
You mean 1740s?
I mean 1840s. The afterwards, okay. During the famine years, you can very much see that it's someone fleeing the famine, fleeing this massive devastation and just seeking a new life. But in the 1740s or in the 1770s, it really is an entire range of people. So some are from the poor, dispossessed backgrounds. They're looking for land, opportunity. They're looking for a new way of life. Others are doing it because they have family members there. They want to be part of this new colonial adventure. They're looking for opportunities to make money, and they see the potential in these American colonies. So I think you see a range of people. Some are going there as colonial administrators. Some are going as soldiers. Some are going who are huge champions of the colonial system, and others are going who very much feel themselves victims of the colonial system. So you do get a complete range of people. And that's why some of the people who end up in the American colonies, you find them on all different sides. Some of them are the worst oppressors when it comes to the Native Americans or African Americans. Some of them are people who are there for land or money. Some of them are there who are very much feeling part of the dispossessed, and others see themselves very much on the part of the side of the American colonial forces.
And to what extent is the Catholic community in Ireland organizing, supporting emigration to the colonies? And to what extent is the Protestant sort of upper ruling class, we might say, doing that? What sense is the Irish Parliament just wanting people to leave? What is this constellation of push factors, I guess is what I'm saying?
Yeah, I suppose a lot of it, it's not something directly that the Parliament is worried about, because the ones who are going as administrators or as part of the colonial system, very much it's seen as these are great opportunities that we get. In fact, they want more opportunities. They want to also have the same opportunities with the East India Company. They want to have these other opportunities around. And then others are going, you know, from the Ulster counties, and they have very much connections there. So you see a mixture of all sides. You see some Presbyterian, some Protestant, some Catholic. And it's not really, it's not really an issue really until the conflict breaks out, and then you see that there are certain sides forming, and that some of those who have left are very much part of now, inspired by the ideals of the American colonists rising up in rebellion, very much inspired by the ideals. But then, as you said at the start, some very much on the other side fighting as part of the British army. And it's hard to know how the Irish at home are viewing it. We do know the newspapers and how they're covering it. We do have some ballads in the Irish language and some folklore and some traditions in the Irish language, which shows some admiration for America. But we have stories of Robert Emmet, who was born in 1778 and who grew up hearing stories from his father, who was the king's physician in Ireland, hearing stories about George Washington And even though they were an elite Protestant family, they were inspired by what they were hearing. And he ended up leading one of those rebellions in 1803 that in itself inspired Patrick Pearse and the 1916 leaders. And he had his own proclamation in 1803. And that was directly inspired by the American Revolution. It inspired Pearse's one in 1916. And he believed, and he always said, that his ambition was to be an Irish George Washington.
Okay, I want to focus a little bit now on the military angle, if that's okay. So we've already established, and we know, that many of the signers of the Declaration of Independence were Irish. One was actually an Irish Catholic. The rest were Irish Protestants. Many Irish men joined Washington's Continental Army. But we also have this idea of Irish soldiers serving in Britain, and they had been stationed in Ireland, and they were moved. So maybe you can just talk about, I mean, it's just so interesting to me, how could an Irish person be fighting in the North American colonies for Britain? And then you have like half of the other side of the Continental Army are Irish men fighting against this person. It's just hard for me to grasp.
And it's probably hard for us to explain, but there is a good way of maybe getting an insight into that, and that's the character of Theobald Wolfetone. So Wolfetone becomes a leading Irish revolutionary in the 1790s. He's the founder of the United Irishmen. He is the organizer and the leader of that 1798 rebellion, which is this crucial rebellion in Ireland. In the summer of that year, it gets crushed by the British, but it is a hugely significant moment, and it's inspired by the American Revolution, the French Revolution, and it's one of those major rebellions in Irish history. Wolfetone, this great revolutionary figure from the 1790s, entered Trinity College Dublin as a student in 1781, and he immediately was petitioning his father to allow him to withdraw from college to join and enlist in the British Army, because he wanted to fight there. And part of it is because he saw the soldiers drilling in the Phoenix Park and around Dublin, and he admired the military uniform, and he also said that uniform makes you more attractive to women, and he thought that this would be better for him. But it's interesting that it shows how Tone, as a young man, wasn't so inspired by the stories of the colonists that he wanted to fight on their side. He was actually prepared to enlist to fight on the other side. And of course, his father refused him permission and he didn't go. And very quickly, Tone realized that that would have been the wrong side. Lord Edward Fitzgerald is the other great leader of the 1798 rebellion. And he actually does fight on the British side in that war. And some of the soldiers in that conflict become leading revolutionaries in the 1790s and in 1798. And I think it's because, well, I think it's partly because some Catholics are fighting in the army, and they join after 1778 because it offers them a way of life and an income, and it offers them some security. And they're not really following these debates, and they're not really choosing sides on the basis of that. This is about an income, this is about security, and this is about a role. And so they go off and fight. And then there are others who do very much feel that strong loyalty to the British Crown. And you see it in the world today, that sometimes you might have a political idea that develops, but it takes a while for it to become widely accepted or appreciated or understood. And so I suspect if you were to have some kind of an opinion poll or referendum in Ireland in 1780 or 1781, I suspect the majority of people would have sided with Britain in the conflict, purely because it was what they knew and that. But it's as time goes on, the ideals then begin to inspire and influence and shape and maybe radicalize the population. But it takes a little bit of time, and it's definitely not as clear cut in 1780, 1781, even that America is going to win. And I suppose that's the big thing. It's America winning that makes the big difference, because when America wins, that shows it is possible to break from the empire. And I think that's something that we probably don't appreciate enough in Ireland or in Europe, that most people would have thought no one has ever broken away from the British Empire. This has never happened. And this American dream will end in failure and defeat. So fair play to them. Let them try what they want to do. But let's be honest, it is going to be crushed. It'll end in failure. They'll be forced back. And we don't want to really have any part of that. But when America succeeds and the United States then is created, well, that changes everything, because that shows that rebellion can work. The British Empire isn't this incredible organization that it's impossible to break away from. It is beatable. And I think that changes everything, because before then, people thought the British Empire was the only show in town. It would never be defeated. It would crush its opposition. And you better just make the best deal within it. But you certainly couldn't take it on.
Yeah, I mean, you raised so many important issues there. One, of course, is that the British Empire was bankrupt after the Seven Years' War in 1763. And one of the reasons that the Parliament and the King angered so many North American colonists is by forcing them to pay, basically, for the war that they fought in themselves. The colonists were fighting themselves in the Seven Years' War. And then we get the Stamp Act and other intolerable acts. And, you know, it was the fact that the empire had become so huge and ungovernable that then they have to anger their own imperial subjects by taxing them, which only makes it more angry and more chaotic and more ungovernable. And there's kind of no way out of this little mess. And the United States take, I guess, the first step out, and then Ireland follows sometime later.
And I think that's the exact same grievance that those Protestants in the Irish Parliament have, that Ireland is there to be taxed, it's there to raise troops, it's there for money, but it's not there for anything else. It's not there to be consulted. It's really only there to serve the interests of Britain. So the Irish people who would have called themselves patriots or loyalists as part of that parliament, they're desperate for the approval and the respect and the love to come from Britain, but they rarely get it. And so they're treated as second class. They treat the Catholics as third class. And there's a hierarchy. There's the Catholics at the very bottom. There's the Presbyterians just above them, but only a little bit above them. Then you have the established Protestants who are in the higher positions, and they're ruling it over Ireland. But when it comes to Britain, they are very much also seen as paddies. And when the Act of Union was being negotiated in 1799 and 1800, abolishing the Irish Parliament and merging the parliaments, when they were even discussing the numbers of Irish lords, the Irish aristocrats, to bring over to the British House of Lords, they wanted to reduce the numbers because they said, we don't want all of these paddies coming in. So that's how they viewed the Irish aristocrats. And they thought the other groupings were much lower down.
We've gone back now to the subject of religion. So I want to maybe just stick on that a little bit here too. My assumption would have been that clearly anyone fighting for the British side in the American Revolutionary War must have been a Protestant, and everyone fighting on the Catholic, on the other side, the American Patriot side, would be Catholic, which of course is a reduction and wrong. Still, the colony of Maryland, practiced religious freedom, and to a great extent, even though the other North American colonies had official religions, Anglicanism was the state religion in Virginia, there wasn't so much religious oppression going on. There were some rules that said you can't be like a governor if you weren't Protestant. But for the most part, I mean, it was okay to be a Catholic. You could be a landholder and all of that. So again, I'm wondering to what extent, like, the Irish Catholics, let's say, in Ireland understood that there was some sort of different and better model of religious freedom in the colonies, and then, of course, in the actual United States, once the Constitution is passed that guarantees freedom of religion.
I think it gradually becomes a significant factor. You mentioned the only Catholic to sign the Declaration, Charles Carroll, and The stories do begin to get circulated in Ireland about how America is offering something different. And you see that, I suppose it's the different shifts in the story from the outbreak of fighting to the Declaration of Independence to the entry of France to Yorktown to the creation of the United States and the Constitution, that over that period of years, America becomes more and more discussed in newspapers. It becomes more and more discussed more broadly amongst the population. And America does become an inspiration. It does become a kind of an ideal or a beacon or a symbol of hope. And it does represent something to the Irish Catholics that maybe there is a way out of the circumstances they find themselves in. And that might mean emigrating to America to try and join that life. And therefore you see increasing numbers from the 1780s on starting to go to America and build a new life there. But it's also influencing the thinking about, well, could we then do something here? But you have to remember, the Irish Catholic community was very much broken down and repressed by those penal laws. Because if you're a Catholic born in 1775, you cannot be educated legally in Ireland. You cannot become a lawyer. You cannot vote. You have no rights. So they're very much an oppressed, broken down community. Now, as I say, that starts to change really because America is afraid, or Britain is afraid of what's happening in America, and they need the Catholics on side. So 1778 Relief Act, 1782. The next big Relief Act is 1793, and that's brought in when Britain goes to war with revolutionary France. So whenever Britain goes to war, it then starts to bring in reforms to help the Catholics in Ireland, and indeed in Britain. Because it needs them. It needs them to be loyal and it needs them to serve in the army. So life becomes a lot better for Irish Catholics legally, 1778, 1782. And then from 1793 on, Catholics have a limited right to vote but can't sit in Parliament. They can become lawyers, but they can't become judges. And that changes the political makeup entirely. So America is influencing Ireland a lot, but it's influencing a group of people and a community which is very much broken down by a century of oppression and repressive legal measures, and just being excluded from politics and from consideration, and even from legal education. There is illegal education through hedge schools, and the rich are able to send their family off to France and other places. So American ideas are coming into that mixture, and French ideas then after 1789. And it does lead to a radicalization. And Ireland becomes very much radicalized in the 1790s, but it's a slow process. It's not that the Declaration of Independence is produced and Ireland is radicalized in 1776. But you could possibly say that by 1796, you have very much a radicalized Catholic population.
My question was going to be something like, how did the Irish Catholics, say, react to the Declaration of Independence? And I got my answer. And it's actually the War of Independence. Winning the War of Independence, or starting even the War of Independence, had secondary unintended consequences. The founders who signed the Declaration of Independence were not thinking, hey, if this happens, we're going to help out some Catholic people in Ireland. That was not even a secondary, tertiary goal of theirs, I don't think. But as a consequence, the War of Independence, forcing Britain to get a little bit afraid of also France and maybe the Catholics riding up, led to more freedoms as an unintended consequence, which is a funny thing that a document like that in a war thousands of miles away could lead to some improvements in the condition of Irish Catholics.
And also it brings in that idea of a republic. Now, suddenly there is an alternative model that people can consider, that we don't have to be a kingdom. We don't have to have King George as our head of state and as the monarch. Actually, we could do something different. And the introduction of the idea of a republic, well, that really terrifies the Irish political elite and the British political elite, because suddenly now we're not looking to a monarch for guidance and for benign rule. We're actually saying maybe we can do this ourselves and maybe we don't need any external force. And so Britain is terrified, and those Irish Protestant parliamentarians, that 300, they are terrified of Ireland now establishing its own republic.
Okay, you were just mentioning the republic, republicanism. And of course, for an American audience, the idea of being very critical of hereditary monarchs comes primarily in our tradition through Thomas Paine's Common Sense. Do you have any idea of how Thomas Paine's Common Sense made its way to Ireland at the time and how it was received?
We know, because we have a lot of different pamphlet versions of it, and we have different annotations we can see, even from the correspondence who was buying it. Paine does become a huge figure in Ireland, and his writings, Common Sense, but also then in the 1780s and after the French Revolution, they become some of the best-selling pamphlets in Ireland. So we do know that they were widely read, they were widely discussed. Did it become part of that language of political radicalization? And it's not just Common Sense. It's also then when he's writing about the French Revolution as well. And then it's that influences Wolfe Tone. And Wolfe Tone's then his pamphlet on Catholics and Catholic emancipation. That becomes the case being made for why these Irish politicians should give full rights to Catholics and otherwise why they should set up their own country. This is all part of that political debate that you see really going on all the way up to those revolutions in 1798 and 1803 and beyond.
Great. So here we have the origins of the concept of a modern republic in the Declaration of Independence and the states transferring its way via Thomas Paine and other ways back to the island of Ireland. Patrick, this has been such an interesting conversation. I feel so much more knowledgeable about Irish history and its connection to the United States and the Declaration of Independence. I asked all my guests, though, to conclude, when you look at this anniversary, 250 years of the American Declaration of Independence, what are your key main takeaways?
Well, it is something we are looking at very closely here in Ireland, because obviously, there's the huge Irish dimension to the story. It's about how the Irish helped create that revolution, played its role in that revolution, and also how that revolution shaped Irish politics. You know, I think it's very likely that we wouldn't have the kind of Irish republic we have now, only for the American example. I think America and France in the 18th century are the two crucial influences on what became the revolutionary tradition. I've heard the Declaration of Independence described as a promissory note, and it sets out some ideals and principles, but some ideals and principles that were still unclear at the time. And I am very much, you know, reminded of Daniel O'Connell's criticisms of it being an incomplete document, because not everyone was included within its terms. And it was even then an imperfect document. But despite its limitations, it did set out some ideals and values and principles about liberty and freedom and democracy that still resonate, that are still so important. I think it's a text that still resonates with us because, you know, the world is imperfect and, you know, democracy is still under threat and freedom is under threat and all of the values that it set out are under threat around the world. And I think the Declaration of Independence reminds us that we always have to fight for those ideals and those values, and that we can never be complacent and say we have now achieved this ideal society. And they are ideals and principles worth fighting for and worth defending for. And so I think it is important to remember 1776 and to remember that text and the text it inspired, like our 1916 proclamation, because in Ireland, we're not a perfect country and we're not a perfect state. And we have our problems with homelessness and housing and in healthcare, but we have some wonderful things as well. And we play our part in the world, and we have a rich and vibrant culture, and we have a democracy, and we have a free people, and we contribute so much to debates about freedom and democracy. So no country is perfect, and that's okay as well. but that we can strive to be something better, and we can strive to live up to the ideals of these men and women who did so much in earlier generations. And so I think we can still be inspired by the 1916 proclamation and by Robert Emmet's proclamation. And they were inspired by Thomas Jefferson's proclamation, and that we can look to 1776 as much for what it represented and what it promised as much as what it achieved. And I think that should still inspire us today.
Professor Patrick Gagan, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Life, liberty, and of happiness. Life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness. Life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness. The pursuit of happiness.
If you enjoyed this podcast and would like to support German-American friendship, why don't you visit us at our website, americatzentrum.de, where you can become a member and donate. The Americatzentrum is a nonpartisan and not-for-profit institution dedicated to strengthening the transatlantic relationship. The views and opinions expressed in the episode are those of the guests or the host, not the Americatzentrum. We take our nonpartisan mission seriously. Therefore, we do not take any institutional positions on politics or policy. Learn more about us, become a member, and donate at americatzentrum.de. Thanks for listening.